What I'm going to talk about today is a project that I've been working on for about the last 4 years. I've been working with some folks with the LSU Ag Center, located primarily in northeast Louisiana. These are entomologists and they're involved in cotton production. What they've wanted to do is use precision agriculture type of experiments in order to develop variable rate treatment prescriptions for commercial cotton operations. And you know, if you're familiar with these kind of experiments, you know that they generate very large data sets, very high density sampling schemes, and data sets like that can exhibit significant spatial correlation, and that has presented a problem that we've been trying to solve and get resolved for the last 4 years. In developing a variable rate treatment prescription, what we need to do is evaluate the effects of the applied treatments in the context of the field characteristics that exist in the field. And in order to do that, we need to, or at least we ought to try to, take into account any kind of spatial correlation that exists in the data. And you know, the question is, how can we accomplish this? You know, there are parametric approaches that one might use. If you're familiar with PROC Mixed, you know, it has parametric spatial covariance structures that you might consider using. But what we found, and we found this out pretty quickly, is that analyzing these kinds of data sets using the structures that were available at the time in Mixed, it was very problematic. And I think it was mainly because of the size of the data sets and the algorithms that were used to implement these structures in SAS PROC Mixed. What I want to do is walk through some analyses that we've done and hopefully found some solutions on how to deal with this in the context of a case study that we worked on. This is a the data that we're going to look at come from a field trial from a commercial cotton farm. This was collected back in 2007 in northeast Louisiana. It was a fairly big farm. The data come from a smaller 33-acre field on that farm. The purpose was to, like I said, evaluate or to construct a variable rate treatment prescription specifically for a nematicide and nitrogen application. Now, this they chose this field because it was known from previous research to have nematode problems. The folks that I've been working with, primarily Gene Burris, is an entomologist, and he's worked for many, many years with nematodes. And this particular field was known to vary spatially with respect to soil type, and this is very common in this part of the country. What they did was they took soil electroconductivity measurements across the entire field, and what they wanted to do was use these ECA measurements as a proxy for soil type. Apparently these kind of measurements correlate well with soil type. And in particular, what they wanted to do was use these different soil types as management zones, okay, for developing this variable rate treatment prescription. And so they used the ECA measurements as a proxy for soil type. And what they did was they categorized these measurements into three categories, basically corresponding to high clay content, medium clay content, and low clay content, again for the purposes of using those zones as management zones. Now, the treatments in the experiment in this embedded field trial consisted of two applied treatments. One was nitrogen. We had three levels. The rates really don't matter. We'll just call them you know, a low rate, medium rate, and high rate. And then we had a nematicide, which either they applied at 3 gallons per acre or they didn't apply at all. Okay, and so we had a complete factorial treatment structure. And then we also had the field characteristic that they measured, in particular the ECA measurements. And like I said, that was categorized into a categorical variable with three levels. The field layout, the field was partitioned into three blocks or three reps. And in talking to the researchers, that they did this before they came and talked to me. It was really not clear why they did this. You know, I'd analyzed data from their experiments in the past, and it seemed like quite often we had three blocks, three reps, and that seemed to be like a magic recipe that they were following. You know, like I said, the field was 33 acres, and so these blocks had about 11 acres per block. I don't know, is that kind of a big block? You know, there was a slight elevation gradient across the field, but I'm not sure that it was strong enough to really warrant the blocks the way they defined them. But anyway, that's what, you know, that's what they used for randomization purposes, and so we wanted to, you know, keep that in mind, you know, when we did the analysis. Within each of these blocks, each of the six nematicide nitrogen treatment combinations were randomly assigned to 24 row-wide plots or strips that ran the length of the field, basically from the southwest to the northeast, as you'll see in a second. Okay, so here's a picture of the field. Up here in the northwest corner, we've got some structures, you know, house or barns or something, and so they did not collect any data there. But you can see the orientation of the field, and then we have the three blocks represented here. And the elevation gradient, you know, like I said, there was a slight elevation gradient, and I believe that it was highest over up in this part of the field and decreased in elevation as we went down. I believe that was how it worked. Here's a plot of the field showing the three EC zones. All right, and so this corresponds to EC zone 1, and this was the area where they had high clay content. And then we have EC zone 2. This was the medium clay content, and then we had the low clay content down here. And the nematode problem was basically up in the northeast part of the field. That's where they predominantly had the problem. Oh, one other thing. The plot also shows these 24 row-wide plots or strips to which they randomized the nitrogen and nematicide treatment combinations. Okay, so each one of these corresponds to 24 rows. Here's a schematic of what one of these 24 row-wide plots looks like. Nitrogen was applied, or the nitrogen application equipment spanned 12 rows, and so within each 24 row wide plot you had two nitrogen application passes. All right. The nematicide application equipment spanned 4 rows, and so within, and they were nested within the nitrogen application passes, and so within each nitrogen application pass you had 3 nematicide application passes. Okay, the harvest equipment, the cotton picker, spanned 6 rows. Okay, the harvest passes were nested within nitrogen application passes. And so within each nitrogen application pass, you had 2 harvest passes. All right, they had a cotton picker that was equipped with a GPS monitor, and they monitored cotton lint yield approximately every 2 seconds. All right, and the resulting data set had 6,008 observations. All right, so in order to analyze this data set, we want to make sure that we account for the variability due to the treatment structure, the variability due to the design of the experiment. And so we want to make sure that we account for the applied treatments, which are the nitrogen rate and the nematicide. We want to make sure that we account for the field characteristic, in this case, the EC zone. Okay, and then we also want to make sure that we account for the variability induced by the manner in which the experiment was performed. And so we've got, we're going to have random effects corresponding to the three reps, okay, within which randomization occurred. We're going to have random effects for the 24 row-wide plots, to which the treatment combinations were randomized. We have potential variability from one nitrogen application pass to the next, and then we also have a potential variability amongst harvest passes. All right, now we also have unmeasured field characteristics, potentially, that could affect yield. Okay, what are the effects of those characteristics, and how do we deal with that? One other thing I want to point out is that there's potential variability due to the nematicide application passes, but there's really no way to tease that apart, tease those effects apart from the nitrogen application passes and the harvest passes. All right. For example, what we're going to be eventually call variability due to application pass really includes not only the variability from an application pass, but also this middle nematicide application pass, because these two things straddle the two harvest passes. And then the harvest passes include not only the variability of the two harvest passes, but also the outermost nematicide application passes within this nitrogen application pass. And so while we can't account for these things specifically, the variability due to those things is contained in, you know, these other effects that we do include in the model. By the way, because the nitrogen application passes straddle the harvest passes, and this is where we have our responses, this is inducing a potential correlation amongst the responses within within the harvest passes within a particular nitrogen application pass. Okay, now here is a plot showing the yield locations, and now what I've done is I've taken that original field plot, and for the purposes of the analyses that we're going to do here later on, I've rotated and shifted the axes so that they correspond to the western and southern edges of the field. All right, so that's why it's a different orientation. But this does show where the plot or where the responses were obtained. You can see it's very, very densely sampled. Like I said, approximately every 2 seconds. And so there's a real potential here for spatial correlation. Okay, and that's just what this slide is saying. All right, so, you know, how to analyze this kind of data. And in particular, you know, how to deal with the spatial correlation. Well, I suppose, you know, we could ignore the spatial correlation. And I'll be honest with you, for the first couple years that we worked with this, with these kind of data sets, this is kind of what we had to do. You know, the first couple years, we were using ProcMixed. And even though ProcMixed has these parametric spatial structures, like a spatial Gaussian, spatial exponential, spatial spherical, you know, it's got a, you know, a whole slew of parametric spatial structures that you can, you know, possibly use. None of these worked. Every time that we would try to run one of these with one of these spatial structures, immediately SAS came back and said it was out of memory. All right, and I called SAS several times, you know, technical support. They said, look, this is a general purpose, ProcMixed is a general purpose, you know, proc, you know, it's not meant for this kind of data set, and so, you know, there was really no way to get around it. And so, you know, what do you do? These guys needed results. And so, you know, we kind of held our nose and did analyses that kind of ignored this spatial correlation. We also tried some things like summarizing the data, binning the data across the field, you know, to alleviate some of the spatial correlation. But, you know, to be honest, as a statistician, and maybe this is exacerbated by the fact that I used to work in the pharmaceutical industry, I don't like to throw away data. You know, that just seems to kind of go against the grain of what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to find methodologies that allow you to use all the data as long as it's okay, and, you know, in the analysis. Another approach is to model a spatial correlation. And that's what we tried to do initially, you know, using these spatial structures in ProcMix. But like I said, the procedure was not able to handle it. So I guess a third attempt might be to try to eliminate or at least reduce the spatial correlation so that its effects are minimized when you assess the effects of the fixed effects in the model. So we're going to look at all, mainly the first, what I'm going to do is show you analysis where we ignore the spatial correlation, okay, because that's what I think a lot of folks are doing out there these days in the precision ag area. Then we're going to look at that third component where we try to do something to eliminate or at least reduce the spatial correlation so that it doesn't have much of an effect, and show you the differences that you can see. Okay, so the response was cotton lint yield. All right, the fixed effects in the model included EC zone, N rate, the nematicide, all two and three-way interactions. And then in order to have a model that's comparable to what we do later on, I'm going to include the spatial locations relative to that rotated and shifted field. Those are called, those covariates are loc X and loc Y. And then we'll include random effects that, you know, corresponding to the design structure of the experiment. So we're going to have random effects for the rep, for plot within rep, for the application passes within plot, and then the harvest passes within application pass. All right, and so this is what the model would look like. Okay, I've got my mean structure defined up here in the model statement. I've got random statements incorporating random effects to account for the design structure of my experiment. And then I'm also going to include an NL options statement here, because if I don't do this, then the solution that I get, I'm not terribly comfortable with, because the gradient that at the final iteration is quite large. And in talking to SAS technical support, this was a way that we could improve that gradient and get an estimate that we had more confidence in. Okay, so here are the some results from this analysis. We've got four G-side parameters corresponding to the random effects for the design structure in the experiment, the variances for rep, plot, application pass, and harvest pass. The number of random effects in the model, the number of columns in the Z-matrix, is 128. Now we've got, this comes from the fact that we have three reps. All right, we've got, let's see here, 18 plots, 36 application passes. 35 of those application passes have two harvest passes. One of those application passes has a single harvest pass, and so we get a total of 128 random effects. And like I said, that's the number of columns in the Z matrix. And I point this out because when we use radial smoother later on, I want to show you where those things end up. And then we have a single R-side parameter. That's the variance of the residual term. Okay, it looks like there's not a whole lot of variability from one rep to the next, partly because they're so huge. All right, there's not a whole lot of variability amongst the plots. There does appear to be significant variability amongst the harvest passes. Okay, and note that the residual variance is approximately 15,600. We'll see how that changes later on. All right, so from the perspective of developing a variable rate treatment prescription, or whether that's even appropriate, I'm interested in these interactions between the EC zone, the management zone, and the various applied treatments. The interaction between EC zone and N rate, between EC zone and nematicide, and then the three-way interaction between EC zone, N rate, and nematicide. And you can see that based on this model that assumes independence, the interactions between EC zone and N rate and EC zone and nematicide are both quite significant, and the three-way interaction between EC zone and N rate and nematicide is almost significant, at least at the 5% level. So this would indicate that a variable rate treatment prescription is appropriate for the field, and then you could go from here and you know, develop that prescription. Okay, the thing we need to be careful of, though, is that, you know, we have not accounted for the potential spatial correlation that could exist. You know, this is an independence model. Are the assumptions of the model valid? And so one way to check this is to construct the semivariogram. okay, from the residuals for the model. And what we can see based on the semivariogram is that the variability of differences between residuals close together, okay, is smaller than the variance of differences of, between residuals that are far apart. And so what this is indicating is that residuals close together tend to be more alike than residuals that are far apart. And so this is evidence of the existence of spatial correlation, okay, amongst the residuals. And so that suggests at least a violation of the assumption of independence that that independence model is imposing on the data.
That was
omnidirectional, right? Yeah, right. And so, you know, we should probably, you know, take those results with a grain of salt, all right, those test of fixed effects. So the next step might be, well, let's see if we can, you know, account for that spatial correlation parametrically using one of the spatial covariance structures in PROC-GLIMIX. Now, I told you that in the past I've used PROC-MIXED, and I've been very frustrated by that because it never seemed to work when I wanted to fit these spatial covariance structures. We can try PROC-GLIMIX. You know, it has basically the same kind of functionality. It has the same suite of parametric spatial structures. And so what I'm trying here is a spatial exponential structure. And I'm trying this, you know, you could try a spatial Gaussian or a spatial spherical. You know, if I look at this semivariogram, you know, it looks to me like it might be approximated by an exponential covariance structure. So it's, you know, at least worth a shot. We can try this. We can try others. And then compare the fits and pick the one that fits the best. Okay, the problem is that when I do this, again, just like what happens with PROC-MIXED, okay, I run out of memory. Okay, and it runs out of memory if you try a spatial Gaussian, a spatial spherical. You know, 6008 is not a really huge data set. I'm sure that some of you may analyze data set that has millions of observations, but apparently when you try to fit this kind of a structure, what it's doing is it's trying to fit an n by n matrix, I guess, or something like that. That's kind of the description that I got when I talked to technical support. So in this case, it's 6008 by 6008 matrix, and so that's causing the problem. Now, I will also say that this is the smallest precision ag data set that these guys have given to me. Okay, I've got some, you know, got one that's over 12,000, another one that's over 20,000 observations. So just adding memory to my computer is not going to solve the problem. As soon as I, you know, solve this problem, I'm going to have, they're going to give me a data set that's got, you know, 40,000 observations. So this apparently is not an approach that's going to work. So the next thing I want to do is use some functionality that is available in GLIMIX. Now, I started working with these guys about 4 years ago. Like I said, we were trying to use PROC-MIXED. Didn't seem to work. About 2 years ago, I started using GLIMIX, and GLIMIX has some nice functionality. It has what's called a radial smoother that we can actually use to try to eliminate or at least reduce the spatial variation, which is causing the spatial correlation. All right, so that's what I'm talking about in this slide. What are the sources of spatial correlation? And I think one big cause is unaccounted for field characteristics that vary spatially across a field. Now, you can also have some correlation induced by the measurement process itself. The way I envision that, though, I think that would tend to be negative correlation. But, you know, regardless, I think that the big source of a lot of this correlation is unaccounted for field characteristics. Failure to adequately account for a trend in a particular dimension can induce spatial correlation among residuals in that dimension. If the response is a continuous function of covariates that vary continuously across a field, then by continuity, locations closer together will tend to have residuals that are more similar than locations far apart. And that induces a positive correlation among the residuals. And the strength of that correlation is going to depend, it's going to be a function of distance. So if the lion's share of the residual spatial correlation that we're seeing stems from unaccounted for trend, then it seems reasonable that if we can account for that trend somehow, we should be able to reduce and possibly eliminate that spatial correlation among the residuals. So the question is, how can we do this? Well, one thing we might try is adding more covariates, if they are available. Now, I really didn't have any extra covariates for this data set, so that was not an option. But if we did have additional covariates, we could think about including those. The question is, that would be a parametric type of fit, and what kind of a structure do we include? Do we include linear terms, interaction terms, quadratic terms, if these are continuous covariates? That can be quite complicated, especially, in two dimensions. If we're looking at residual plots in two dimensions, it can be kind of complicated or, difficult to figure out what exactly, we should include when it comes to including these covariates. Okay, and then the other problem, like I said, is what if you don't have any more covariates? Well, the radial smoother that GLIMMIX has basically is an implementation of a non-parametric smoothing spline, and that can be used to account for some of this trend. Non-parametric smoothing splines, when you combine them with a parametric model, result in what's called a semi-parametric model. And when I initially looked at this, these radial smoothers, it was really not clear to me what it was doing, but it turns out that these semi-parametric models, you can think of these basically as an analysis of covariance model, where the smoothing spline is playing the part of the covariate. It's a set of covariates. All right? Certain semi-parametric models, not all of them, but certain semi-parametric models, and in particular these radial smoothers, have representations as mixed models. And so when they have that representation, they can be implemented as or using mixed model software. Okay, SAS 9.2 in the GLIMMIX includes GLIMMIX as part of the package, and GLIMMIX has the ability to fit a radial smoother as a random effect. Okay, and so you can include a radial smoother in your model, resulting in a semi-parametric model, and you basically have a semi-parametric model that includes a penalized non-parametric smoothing spline, okay, that you can use to account for some of this residual trend. All right, so to fit a model with this radial smoother, because this is implemented as a random effect, okay, we include a random statement that has the spatial covariates, okay, as the argument to the option or to the statement. And then we specify a type equal to R, type equal R smooth for radial smoother. There are a variety of ways of constructing the radial smoother. To construct the radial smoother, you have to have knots placed on the field, and there are some options that you can use in SAS to do this. How many knots to use? That's a big question that you need to answer. I'm not going to go into the details of how we did this, but what we ended up using were we laid out a lattice, and this is the reason we rotated and shifted the axes. We laid out a lattice over the field, a 20 by 20 lattice, and threw out 400 knots. Now remember, up in the northwest part of the field, we had that blank area. We didn't have any measurements because of a barn or something. So we took out the knots that ended up being in there. So we ended up with 384 knots. Okay. To get the placement of those knots, I used ProcGLIMMIX with a no-fit option, and it created the knot locations. And then I saved those knots to a data set, and then ran a data step to get rid of the ones up in the upper left part or corner of the field. And then I'm reading those knots back in here using this statement. All right, so knot method equal data. It's telling it to go read the knots from a data set, and then from the knot info data set, which I had subsequently created. Okay. Here's a graph showing the placement of the knots. Again, I've got 384 knots out there, so you can see that they're spread out all across the field in a very uniform fashion. Now, we tried anywhere from, I think, 36 knots up to about 1,024, okay? And this seemed to give us, this was about the minimum number of knots that we could use and get results that we felt were reliable. Okay, now let's look at the dimensions table from the analysis. Okay, in the independence model, we had 4 G-side parameters. Now we have an additional G-side parameter for a total of 5. That additional parameter is the variance of the radial smoother. Now, like I said, the radial smoother is a penalized nonparametric spline, and the penalty term is a function of the variance of the radial smoother and the variance of the residual. Okay, and so there's kind of a built-in automatic penalty that is imposed, and it's a function of the ratio of those two parameters. We also notice that the number of columns in the Z matrix, okay, which is used to identify the random effects, we now have 512 columns in that matrix. That comes from the 128 that we originally had in the independence model, plus the 384 knots that we laid out. So those knots correspond to random effects in this model. We don't have any change in the number of R-side parameters, so we still have 1 there. Okay. Really, the only thing that I want to point out here is that notice that the residual has been knocked down from around 15.6 down to about 11.3. So we've knocked it down by including the radial smoother, okay, this nonparametric smoothing spline. We're accounting for quite a bit of additional variability, and we've knocked it down by about 28%. So that's a fairly significant reduction in the error variance estimate. Okay, when we assess the significance of the fixed effects, we see that for this model, excuse me, the interaction between the nitrogen rate and EC zone, while it was significant in the independence model, it's not close to being significant now. And while the three-way interaction was close to being significant in the independence model, again, it's not significant in this case. On the other hand, the interaction between EC zone and nematicide is still significant, although it's not as significant. And so when you look at this, the conclusion would be that for the nitrogen rate, it looks like a blanket rate is going to be appropriate, so then you could do the main effect comparisons to figure out what rate to apply. But for the for nematicide, it would look like a variable rate treatment prescription is still something you'd want to do here. Okay, now one thing to keep in mind is that this is still an independent errors model. We don't have any kind of spatial or parametric spatial component in the model. So this model is still assuming independent errors. And the question is, you know, is that a reasonable assumption, you know, based on this analysis? And if we construct a semivariogram of the conditional residuals, okay, this is what it looks like. And we don't have this dip that we had before. We do have this, you know, one point down here, but once we get beyond, you know, a very short distance, this thing is pretty flat. So what that would indicate is that over most distances here, it looks like the observations are uncorrelated. In order to interpret this, we have to kind of dig in a little deeper. And what it looks like to me is that adjacent residuals in the same harvest pass have a negligible, or at most a weak, level of correlation between them. And this is based on the SIL estimate and the level of the semivariogram here. All right. My recollection is that the correlation amongst adjacent residuals within the same harvest pass was around 0.2, I think, whereas in the independence model it was approximately 0.6 or 0.7. All right. So that that correlation has been reduced significantly. Non-adjacent residuals in the same harvest pass are essentially uncorrelated, and residuals in different harvest passes are uncorrelated as well. And so it looks like the assumption of independent errors is much more plausible with this model. Now, I will say that in the most recent version of SAS that's available, 922, PROC Variogram has been significantly overhauled, and it has the ability to fit parametric variogram models. And I've been playing with this the last couple days. When I first saw this, I thought maybe this was that we had mainly independence, and this might be a nugget effect. You know, but I wasn't really sure because of how these semivariograms are estimated. I wasn't sure that you could actually get a real good estimate of a nugget effect. But in fitting a, say, an exponential spatial structure using Prague variogram, it looks like that may in fact be the case, that we have a nugget effect and that beyond, say, three distance units, that things are basically uncorrelated. And if that's the case, then that would imply that adjacent observations in the same harvest pass are uncorrelated. So I'm still a little up in the air about what this means, but I think the worst case is that adjacent residuals are, you know, weakly or weakly correlated. Okay, so in conclusion, spatial correlation, you know, it needs to be dealt with if we want to be able to make valid inferences about the fixed effects in our models. Spatial correlation can be the result of unaccounted for trend. To the extent that this is the case, spatial correlation can be reduced and possibly eliminated by accounting for that residual trend. A nonparametric smoothing spline can be used to account for complex residual trend. These nonparametric smoothers can take quite complicated shapes. Now, the one downside to using a radial smoother is that it's a penalized spline, so there's going to be a limit to how wiggly it can get. All right, but we can at least try and see what we get. A linear mixed model with the radial smoother provided by the SAS-GLIMIX procedure can be used to account for residual trend and thereby reduce or eliminate residual spatial correlation, leading to more valid inferences about the fixed effects in the model, which ultimately leads to better variable rate treatment prescriptions. That's it. Any questions?
Could you put up your residuals that show spatial variability?
The first one or the second one?
First one.
Okay.
If you created 384 cells in that field and did essentially the initial analysis that you did before, essentially smoothing in a different way, did you not capture that spatial variability at the scale that you're seeing in the center?
So are you talking about create these cells and then summarize within the cells?
Yes, just doing the BMU cell, essentially subsetting the data, doing smoothing.
Yeah, in fact, you know, we haven't done that on this data set, but one of the initial approaches that we tried back in around 2006 was doing something like that. And I think that you can alleviate some of that spatial correlation, perhaps a lot of it. The question is, the problem is, you know, can you, when you do that, you know, you have to make sure that those cells are within the various, that they don't overlap two or more field management zones. Now, another reason, you know, a reason that I don't like to do that is because I'm not a GIS person and I don't have GIS software, and so, you know, I don't really have the tools to do that. It's very difficult to do in SAS. Now, if we had somebody in our department or associated with a project that could do that, then that might be a more feasible approach for us. But
And what's, if I use the term sphere of influence,
well, what they're doing is they are, if you think about what the mean structure is doing, okay, you're creating a surface, right, a response surface, and then the knots, you know, these are random effects, so they're allowing you to have bumpiness in that, you know, in that response surface. So it's creating a bumpier surface to try to capture some of that variability.
I understand that.
Yeah.
The data baggage that go into that bumpy surface, if we did a semivariogram, for example, capturing that, we would have some radius of influence of that. We have 6 observations, 12 observations, 20 observations that we use in terms of smoothing that. When you do your knots, is it discrete within the cell around the knots? Does it go over the entire field? Is it local smoothing or is it a global smoothing?
You know, that's a good question. I'm thinking back to what that radial smoothing function looks like, and I believe that these functions are not truncated, okay, that you're going to see an effect across the entire field. Mary, do you know?
I don't know.
I don't think they're truncated. Yeah, I don't think they're truncated.
It's more like kriging, where you don't define a neighborhood, and it's bringing in information from the whole area. You don't think it's like locally weighted?
No, yeah, it's not like that. You know, I was, you know, you can use truncated power functions in one dimension, so you're going to have truncation on one side with those. But this one, you know, these radial power functions, it's essentially, yeah, there's no neighborhood to it. Yeah. I think it's if I remember correctly, it's either a first order or a third order difference. Polynomial, you know, so difference raised to the first or third order. I don't remember which one.
I mean, it was part of the question and answer period.
How much time did you spend? I mean, did you like try two or three radial smoothers and different numbers of knots and all that? Or how labor intensive is this?
Well, all right, so the question of. So the question was, you know, how labor-intensive was this? How many different radial smoothers did we try? How many different numbers of knots? And I haven't included those results in the slides, but I think I'd said previously that we went up from, say, around 36 knots up to 1,024, all right? And one of the books that I was referring to get information on this was, let's see, Rupert Wand and Carroll. And In that book, they talk about typically needing between around 30 up to around 150 knots, but no more. And what we found very quickly was that 150 knots was nowhere near enough. You know, what we were doing to assess the number of knots that we would need was looking at a generalized cross-validation statistic, and we were hoping that at some point, you know, it would decrease as we increased the number of knots and then come back up. It kept going down. I got to 150 knots or so, and it kept going down. So we kept adding more knots and more knots. And it never came back up, but it did start to attenuate in its decrease. And so then the question was, okay, you know, how do we choose the number of knots to use? And so basically what we decided to do was to look at how stable are the inferences for the fixed effects. At what point do those inferences stabilize? We looked at the generalized cross-validation statistic, all right, to see where it kind of leveled off, or at least the decrease was fairly small. And so when you look at these things, oh, and also at what point did the semivariogram look like, you know, we didn't have a whole lot of spatial correlation existing in the data. You know, at what point did we take care of that? And about 400 knots, you know, minus the ones on the upper left, so 384 knots was really about the smallest number of knots that we could use and get away with that. Now, when we used, you know, 1,024, it seemed like maybe we were kind of overfitting, you know, so we wanted to stay away from using too many knots for that reason, but also because the more knots you use, the more time-consuming the analysis takes. You know, they take several hours, typically, when you have a large number of knots. So there was some, you know, trial and error in terms of looking at the number of knots to use, you know, so, yeah.
You had commented about the spatial correlation could be an unobserved covariate. You actually had a continuous covariate that you turned into a category.
Right, right.
Did you consider looking at
a parent EC directly? Yeah, so they had this electroconductivity continuous measurement that they collected, and they are the ones who categorized it, and they categorized it for the purpose because they wanted to use that, you know, as a management zone. Now I have that raw data. I could continue to use that. You know, I'm not using it for the purposes of this, you know, particular example to show what you can do with radial smoothers.
Well, it just takes you right back into the problem of if you do have the continuous, as you pointed out, it's not going to be a nice plane in two dimensions. Surface
product. Exactly. Right, right, right.
You just want to get rid of the autocorrelation and the residual, so you have the right error terms.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it amounts to.
Right, right.
In this case, they don't care. They just want it out. You know?
We don't want to make inferences about the random effects. We want to account for that, you know, appropriately so that we can make valid inferences about the fixed effects. Edzard?
Kevin, what's the effect of this was that for the agronomist that would be?
Right, right. That is, that's a good question. It does have an effect. If my collaborator has any question or objection to this method, it's the effect that that does have on the mean, and it seemed to shrink things towards zero. Which, if what you're doing is just wanting to evaluate or compare treatment effects, maybe that's not a big deal. But one of the things that we were doing was instead of using yield as a response, using profit, we were taking into account costs and all that kind of thing. And when we did that, it was not a very realistic picture. You know, I mean, we could still make the comparisons, but the profit values didn't look like they ought to. And so, you know, that's still something that I'm looking into.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to compare means. I want to give my producers a model that says this is what you need to do when you get something, when you get A and when you get B, you're going to get Y. You know? So do you think doing this or maybe going out and maybe possibly collecting more of those prior, that way you don't have to do this meeting, would be the better option as a more agronomist?
Well, yeah, I think that I think you're going to see that. I think that people are going to be collecting more and more data, you know, as time goes on. They didn't have that here, and they needed an answer. You know, the producer, they spent a lot of money buying this equipment, collecting the data, and so they needed some kind of analysis that they could use to come up with what are we going to do, what should we apply in these different areas. And I guess what I would say is that what I'm doing here, in comparing the treatment effects, this is not the end result. Okay, this is an intermediate result. Once we determine, whether or not it's important to construct a variable rate treatment prescription, then we go ahead and we use the results of the model and figure out, okay, in these various, in the different management zones, this is what you should apply. So what we end up giving them is, basically a treatment prescription that tells them exactly what to apply, in each part of the field. I mean, is that what you're talking about in terms of wanting to know?
Because, going from the ground, the EC is a faulty at best way of doing management zones. So I was just thinking, if I, as a researcher, would go out and collect a better estimate of management zones, do you think that would be more?
Oh, yeah. However,
take this to me, then
sure. However, you see the larger picture here is that, and maybe I didn't say this, but in order to, this kind of stuff and develop these treatment prescriptions can be very, very time-consuming from on the statistician, in comparing the treatment effects within the various management zones. And so what I did for these guys was develop a system that takes the results of the statistical analyses and then develops the treatment prescriptions automatically. So it's a fairly automatic process. What's not automatic is the statistical analysis, and I don't think this should be automatic. You laugh, but I know people that are wanting to black box this entire process, and I don't like that. But anyway, whatever treatment management zones you come up with, okay, you just provide that to me in a data set along with the results of some kind of experiment like this, and we'll develop a treatment prescription for, based on those management zones. So, however you want to define them.
Are there any other specific questions for Kevin? If not, you can also have an opportunity to ask Mary or Walt any follow-up questions from their talks earlier today.
I don't know if this is exactly related to the talks, but do you have a suggestion for, a best source for sort of theory behind Linux and so on?
Oliver Schaumburger has a book on statistical methods in ag sciences, but I'm not sure how much of that includes the new Linux models, because I think the book...
No, he wrote it considerably. He wrote it before he went to that.
Yeah, unfortunately he wrote it, I think, before he did most of the development, so.
There's,
although it's a good basic text.
I'm in the process of writing one.
There you go. There's one money.
For the theory, it's not connected with Prop Land Mix, but Oliver's book, and there's one that Chuck McCullough and Chael Searle wrote, which I think there's a second edition that came out, and one additional author joined them. It's called Generalized Linear and Mixed Models.
Yeah,
is the title.
It's about that thick.
Yes. There's one that Muhlenbergs and Rebecca wrote, which Oliver says is the only one that has been published to date that actually specifically mentions certain mixed routines, but it's very oriented toward biomedical research, and I don't think it's, you know, Oliver's would have the advantage of it was written, it's a modeling book, but it's written specifically around crop science examples. So it's a lot easier to follow in a relevant way. And you kind of look at all those models, and there's a lot of prop mix text and prop gen mod examples, which could be translated into GlenMix. And then you could say, well, at some points when he gives examples in prop gen mod and say, well, GenMod won't actually handle the random effects. You can just say, well, now that I have GlenMix, I could write the code how it would look and see how it behaves. Those are probably the two best things that are out there right now.
Do you remember the name of Muhlenberg and Rebecca?
It's something like Mixed Model Analysis for Discrete Variables. So it's real focused on counts and
binomials.
Yeah, it's a Springer text. Those are by far, those three are head and shoulders above anything else that's out there right now.
There's an introductory one on generalized models, right? But what's his name? From Australia, what's her name?
Oh, Annette Dobson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But is it
there's nothing about mixed effects in there.
But for generalized models.
Yeah, for generalized models.
What you need is the mixed part.
Yeah.
And there's virtually no discussion of the marginal and conditional issue, and I think that's partly because until GlenMix came out and people started seriously working with this, I don't think it really hit people the full implications of the distinction between those two. Mm-hmm. So we're just beginning to think about it seriously. In fact, as we've written this monograph for the Tri-Societies, I think those of us who have been involved in it have evolved in our thinking dramatically during the last year. From this is sort of a, you know, some people ought to know about, to, oh my gosh, this is really important. I mean, this is a, you know, almost a fundamental change in the way of thinking about what we're doing.
Yeah.
I want to thank our speakers again today. Thank you for your time and your effort.